whole body burns bright. "Dispel," says Dylan, holding up a hand to shield his eyes. "You almost got too bright there for a second. That was so cool."
"You think that was cool?" asks Dylan. "Check this out."
He waves over the spellbook and opens it to the last page. The only thing written on there is "The End," with a picture of a black leather book beneath the words. It's the old cover, before I used a spell to turn the book red. Dylan extends two fingers and waves them over the page. "Dispel." The book begins to shake, and suddenly, this isn't the last page anymore. It's closer to the middle, and more words appear under the end, so that the page now says, "The end of fair magic and the beginning of magic most foul." Dylan turns the page. "That you have found these pages speaks to a willingness to wield more than what fair magic can provide. However, this pursuit comes with a dire warning. The foul magic contained on the following pages is not for the faint of heart. As I learned in their creation, uttering these spells will cost you. For once, innocence is lost. It cannot be regained." Magnophobia allows an illusionist the ability to pull the very darkest fears from your opponent's mind, to craft an illusion around them that they shall believe is real. As its name suggests, this spell can inflict great mental harm. Do not use it lightly. Stare into your opponent's eyes. "I slam the book shut. Why would you show me that?" Dylan blinks, his face flushing. "I know these spells sound awful, but we need to be able to protect ourselves. You saw how far people are willing to go because they don't like us. I just don't want anything to happen to you is all. Self-defense only."
"I don't care," I say. "I don't want to learn anything like that."
I didn't realize my magic could be that dark. Is it any wonder people fear magicians?
"You might not have a choice, Amari. If you were ever to be challenged by another magician, you could have your magic stolen. Magicians don't survive that."
"I said no," I say firmly. I get that he's only trying to protect me. And maybe I'm being dumb. But the thought of having that kind of power over people scares me a lot more than another magician does. I don't want to learn magic to hurt people. I won't be like Moreau and those other bad magicians. And you shouldn't use that stuff either.
Dylan raises his palms in surrender. "Sorry. You're probably right. I guess I just thought, well, let me make it up to you. There's something else I've wanted to show you, but it'll mean using my dad's transporter. I don't know. Fair or not, I'd be lying if I said I don't look at Dylan a little differently now. It's about teaching you to use your illusions," says Dylan, "something that's not in your spellbook." "Fair magic, right?" I ask, remembering what the book called it. "Not foul magic. Totally fair magic," Dylan says. "I promise." Maybe I am being a little harsh. He's only ever tried to help me.
"Okay, then.
Grab hold of my arm," says Dylan. "It's going to feel a little weird the first time you transport." I nod and wrap my arm around Dylan's. "It can't be that bad, can it?"
He reaches over and presses a button on his metal armband. Suddenly, I get the strange sensation that I'm falling, my living room blurring around me. A moment later, there's something solid beneath my feet, and a cool breeze whips across my face. It takes me a few blinks to shake my dizziness, but once it's gone, I stare out at a large lake that sparkles in the moonlight.
"Where are we?" I ask, my knees still a little wobbly from being transported.
Dylan turns to look over his shoulder,
where a huge house sits between the trees. The old Van Housing Lake House. It's been in the family for ages, but I'm the only one who comes here anymore. Follow me. He dashes toward the house. I follow, excited to see what he has to show me. We head through the front door and into a big, empty living room. Dylan leads me to a doorway near the back. I may not be as strong an illusionist as you are, but it's still my favorite kind of magic. Painting illusions is sort of my hobby. Is that what you wanted to show me? I ask. One of your illusions? Dylan nods and pushes open the door, revealing a staircase leading down to another door. I've been working on this one for a couple months now. I thought maybe you could add to it if you wanted. I don't know if I'm good enough. Don't worry, says Dylan. I'll show you how. He opens the second door, and I gasp. Dylan's illusion is a whole forest of twinkling neon lights. Trees and bushes with shimmering leaves of blue and pink and purple. I've got almost the whole basement covered. Come on, I'll lead you through. I follow Dylan down a little winding path, my eyes darting back and forth, trying to see everything at once. A butterfly with red and gold wings flutters by my face, and squirrels with glittery silver fur race up trees when we get too close. It all feels so real that it takes a second to realize that I can actually hear the sounds of animals. I didn't know illusions could do so much. You made all this? I ask. Dylan looks back over his shoulder and smiles. Pretty cool, huh? Really cool, I say. We continue until we reach the point where the forest ends and the stone basement begins. This is as far as I've gotten. I thought this would be a great spot to put something of yours. Of mine? Is there a spell for forest making or something? Dylan laughs and shakes his head. The spellbook shows you how to create automatic illusions, but you can also paint them manually, too. He reaches out with his pointer finger and draws a glowing white bird onto my shoulder. It hops to life with a few chirps and then flutters off into the forest. It even sounds like a real bird. Once you practice enough, there'll be no sense you can't fool. Your illusions can make sounds, have bad smells, or even feel real to the touch. I've never actually tried to taste one, but it seems like it would work. Can you show me how? I ask. Dylan says the secret to making an illusion is to focus on an image in your head and imagine it pouring out of your fingers. He says to start off with something small and not alive. So we begin with making an extra button on his shirt. It takes me like 30 minutes, but finally, a button appears just like I imagined it in my head. Painting manual illusions is a lot harder than the automatic illusions. Awesome, says Dylan. Let's do one together. He leads me over to the path and paints a tiny green sprout that grows through a crack in the concrete. This reminds me of you. How come? I ask. Because you haven't let where you come from, or what you are, make you give up. At least not yet. You just keep fighting through it. I feel my cheeks flush, and we're both quiet for a while. Suddenly, my hand reaches out on its own, and with a twirl of my fingers, Dylan's sprout grows and blooms with petals of sparkling clear glass. It twinkles like a rainbow in the neon lights of Dylan's forest. That's beautiful, says Dylan. I don't know how I just did that, I say, staring at my hand. Sometimes your magic will take over for you if you let it, says Dylan. How about we call it an Amari blossom? I smile. I think I like that. 22. The last thing I expect to hear when Dylan transports me back to my apartment is voices in the living room. A tall white guy sits in one of our kitchen chairs, facing away from me. Detective, written in big yellow letters across the back of his dark blue jacket. Mama sits on the opposite side of the room, with her head down. I push Dylan into the hallway before Mama can look up.
You have to go.
I will, he says softly. But am I going to have a partner on Monday?
I don't know, I say. But you really have to go, okay?
I'm going.
But I hope you do come back.
Dylan taps his armband and vanishes. I close my eyes and lean my head against the wall. That was so close. What in the world is Mama even doing home this early? Did the police call her? Could they have found something? With so many questions bouncing around my head, I decide to slide to the end of the hallway and have a listen.
I know it's not what you wanted to hear, says the detective. But please don't think we're giving up on Quentin. We're simply out of leads at this point. Our detectives have to move on to new cases. But rest assured that if anything new comes in, we'll be right back on your son's case.
Mama nods. I understand. She looks so small, bunched up on the couch like that, so defeated. I hate it. The detective leans back now.
You know, I've worked this neighborhood for 20 years, both as a beat cop and a detective. Seen the same pattern again and again. A son gets tired of seeing his mother struggle and decides to do something about it. Start to participate in activities that ain't exactly on the up and up. He don't want his mom to be disappointed in him, so he keeps it under wraps. Claims he got a job. You see where I'm going with this?
I do, says Mama.
But I told you, Quentin was working.
Working, you say? Asks the detective.
Ever been to this job? Seen a paycheck or even a check stub?
Mama drops her eyes and frowns.
I've heard enough. I stomp into the living room.
Leave her alone!
Both the detective and Mama jump in surprise.
Amari, says Mama, what are you doing here?
I'm so focused on the detective, I barely even hear her. She's already answered your question, so just go.
I know this ain't easy, says the detective, especially coming from somebody like me.
But I don't care, okay? You can just come in here and say stuff like that when you don't know. You can't assume what my brother is like just because of where we're from. Quentin is a good person, the best person, and I'm not going to let you just say whatever you want about him.
Amari, says Mama.
All right, says the detective, getting to his feet. He ignores me and speaks directly to Mama. Wasn't my intention to start any trouble.
Mama takes a shaky breath.
Thank you, detective.
I slam the door shut behind him. Mama covers her face, crying. I go over and take a seat beside her and say,
I meant what I said. You should hear the kinds of things they say about Quentin.
But Mama just shakes her head.
What Quentin did in that leadership camp doesn't matter, baby girl.
What can I say to make her understand the truth? I could try to come up with a way to explain the Bureau to her, but how can I do that without sounding like I'm making it up? I could show her a spell, but then she'd freak. And there's no telling how the Bureau would react if they found out. Would I get in trouble? Would we both get in trouble? But watching her cry like this is too hard. I have to do something.
You shouldn't have blown up at that detective like that, says Mama. He's just trying to help.
I can't believe what I'm hearing. But he was wrong about Quentin. You know that.
I don't know that, says Mama, her voice harsh.
I have no idea what Quentin was doing. For all we know, he got caught up in the same mess as so many of the young men from around here. Mama. I'm too stunned to say anything else. She gets up and trudges into the hallway. I hear her bedroom door close. And that's when I realize I'm crying too. But not because I'm sad. I'm mad. Mad at whoever's keeping Quentin away from us. And mad at myself for ever becoming so scared that I'd consider giving up on my brother. I've got to be stronger than I've been. No matter how bad those other kids make me feel, nothing's worse than seeing Mama hurt like this. I've got to bring Quentin home. If only to prove to Mama that her son is everything she's always thought him to be, and more. After munching on a Hot Pocket, I go ahead and iron Mama's work uniform and hang it up on her doorknob. The light in her room is out, so hopefully she was able to fall asleep. Even though it's been a couple hours since that detective left, I'm still so frustrated that there's no way I'll be falling asleep anytime soon. So I grab my cell phone, plug in my earbuds, and head upstairs to the roof. The night sky is still cloudy, so it's even darker than usual. Cautiously, I take a seat right at the edge of the roof and let my feet dangle over the side. I can hear both Quentin's and Mama's voices in my head, telling me to come back to where it's safer. But honestly, it feels good not to listen for once. To be scared of something and do it anyway. If I'm going back to the bureau, this is good practice. Amari. I whip around to see Jaden coming up behind me. What are you doing up here this late? He just smiles and plops down beside me. Ma's new boyfriend don't like having me around, so I'll come up here till they fall asleep. How about you? Thought you were out doing fancy kid stuff. I laugh at that. Trust me, there's nothing fancy about Amari Peters. The kids at the bureau make sure I know it too. Yeah, right, he says. You're practically a legend in the wood. I raise an eyebrow, and he laughs. I'm serious, he adds. People in the neighborhood love them some Peters, and not just your brother either. You too. We all think you're gonna be president or something. No, they talk about me because of my brother. There's a big difference. I'm not good at everything like he is. Jaden looks at me like he has no clue what I'm talking about. So you didn't get all the school awards back in elementary school? And I guess they just give anybody a scholarship to those rich kid schools, huh? Oh, be quiet, I say, blushing a little. I get it, though, he says. Can't be easy having Quentin Peters as your brother. It's like being the second best basketball player in the whole world, but your brother is the best. You'd grow up losing all the time and thinking you suck. But everybody else, the people watching, we see you pulling off moves we only wish we could. We're able to see how great you are. I open my mouth, but don't know what to say. Jaden's phone rings, and his whole expression sours. He sighs as he gets to his feet. Jaden, I say. I'm trying to get myself out of the wood, boys. I really am, he says. You and Quentin will still help me when I do, right? I nod. Definitely. He grins and nods too, then disappears down the stairwell. Jaden's words stay on the roof with me. I have always compared myself to Quentin and never felt like I measured up. My brother is good at everything without even trying, because that's his supernatural ability, I realize. Quentin has super genius aptitude. Director Van Helsing said it gives him the ability to learn anything with ease. Why haven't I ever realized this before now? My whole life I've been comparing my best efforts to my brother's supernatural efforts. Of course I'd fall short. My phone rings. I take a look at the screen.
thinking it has to be Elsie. But the phone number is blocked out, and the caller ID just says, "Surprise."
Huh?
Maybe Dylan, then. That tech magic of his. I tap to answer and say, "Hello?" At first, there's nothing. Then a robotic voice comes on the line. "Enemies of magician kind, you were warned what would happen if our demands weren't met. Now suffer the consequences." The call ends.
Consequences?
A message pops up on my screen. It's a video, shot from overhead. I squint down at my phone, at footage of massive creatures sprinting across someone's front lawn. They look like those hulking creatures Moreau showed me back in Blackstone Prison. Hybrids. Once they reach a mansion, the monsters don't even break stride, bursting through the front doors and shattering the wall of windows.
No.
I recognize that house. I saw it on Lara's Eorg page. That's Van Helsing Manor. The scene changes to another mansion, then another, all overrun by hybrids. When it finally ends, I get to my feet and open up my own Eorg page. Hands shaking, I contact Dylan the only way I know how. From Amari_Peters. "I just got a weird video showing your house being attacked. Are you okay?" I pace back and forth across the roof waiting for a reply from Magician Girl 18, aka my partner. Instead, I get a call from Elsie.
"Oh my gosh, do you know if the Van Helsings are okay?" she asks.
"I don't know."
"Wait, you got that video too?"
"Yeah," she says.
"So did my mom and her coworkers at the Department of Creature Control. I think it went out to the entire bureau."
23. I don't hear from Dylan until the next day. He video calls me from inside the Department of Supernatural Health, sporting an ugly bruise on his forehead. I must make a face because he says, "You should have seen me before the healers."
"But you're all right?" I ask. "Is your family okay?"
"Well, Mom and Lara were touring this year's Heartland Crop Circle Art Festival, so it was just me and Dad there when the hybrid stormed in. I tried to fight them off as I ran to find him, but one of them clawed me pretty good. We barely made it out of there."
"Thank goodness," I say. I wasn't sure what to think when I got that strange phone call and video.
Dylan's expression turns serious. "I just keep thinking, what if everyone was home for the weekend like usual? Would we all have made it out? Lara's room is on that side of the house. Moreau's people went after my family, Amari. Again."
"I know," I say. "It's awful."
Lara and I might not get along, but I'd never wish for her to get hurt. Dad says the attacks were against old legacy families. Our house wasn't even the worst hit, he says. A lot of people got hurt. Some didn't make it. Billy Pogo's unnatural luck saved him. But he lost both his parents. He's not coming back to the Bureau this summer. I shudder at the realization of what he's saying. I couldn't imagine losing Mama. "I want to be the one to stop them," Dylan says solemnly. "Promise you'll help me make Junior Agent. You know we make a great team." "I've already decided to go back," I say, "because I plan to be the one to bring Quentin and Maria home."
"Are we going to be Vanquish 2.0?
he asks, with a small smile. "We made a pretty good team the other day." I nod. "From now on, we share whatever we find." Deal. Mama's doing a lot better by the time Sunday comes around. Neither of us brings up the other night. We mainly just talk about how well I'm doing at leadership camp. It seems to lift her spirits some.
As we turn onto the tree-lined drive of the Vanderbilt Hotel, I tell her how I'm ranked first in my group. I leave out the part about me feeling like an outsider, just like I did back at Jefferson Academy. That would only make Mama worry, and she already looks exhausted from the extra shifts she's been working. She even worked a half shift this morning. I'm so proud of you, baby girl. Doing well here can open so many doors for you. I know, Mama. I meant to give a more cheerful answer, but the sight of the hotel sends a shiver through me. As much as I've tried to prepare myself, the thought of facing the other kids is still pretty scary, especially after the latest hybrid attack. If the other kids weren't fond of having a magician in the bureau before, I can only guess what they'll be thinking now. Mama looks at me for a second. You'd tell me if anything was wrong, wouldn't you? I'm fine, I say, just feeling a little sleepy. I even throw in a fake yawn. I'm not sure if a well-rested mama would buy my excuse, but since she's as tired as I'm pretending to be, she just nods. Okay, well, make sure you get some rest once you get to your room. Mama loves you. I love you too, I say. I glance up at the hotel as we come to a stop in the drop-off area. Welp, here goes. I keep my head down as I move through the lobby and into the elevator. I stand all the way in the back, behind a couple of mummies headed for the Department of the Dead. Once they've shuffled off into the gloom of the department's lobby, I ask the elevator to give me a few minutes to think. The second tryout is the Friday after next, meaning I've got about 11 days to learn as much as I can about Quentin and Maria's disappearance before I have to prove myself again. It's not a lot of time. My usual doubts creep in, but then so do Jaden's words. I've been comparing myself to Quentin for too long. I passed the first tryout well enough, so why can't I pass the second? And maybe I'm capable of finding Vanquish too. It's time I start believing in myself. I think back on what I've learned so far. Moreau's apprentice tried to trade Quentin and Maria for Moreau's release and possibly the Black Book. But the Bureau refused, and Moreau's apprentice started attacking the Bureau with hybrids, including that awful attack last night. Moreau said the reason my brother was kidnapped was that he found something Moreau's apprentice wanted, something Quentin shouldn't have been looking for. And Lara said Maria was helping him, even though they weren't partners anymore. But what did they find? Our only clue, a calendar entry on Quentin's computer from the night they went missing. Something about contacting KH and a meeting with Director Horace. Thankfully, the director is supposed to return from the Wandering Isles today. Seeing as I've got no clue what KH stands for, there's really only one thing to do. Take me to the Department of Good Fortunes and Bad Omens, I tell Lucy. That department can only be visited by appointment, she replies. Would you like to schedule one? I guess. When's the soonest I can speak to Director Horace? That would be the middle of next week, says Lucy. People tend to book up spots for readings in uncertain times such as these. That long? Afraid so. Fine. Just tell him it's really urgent. I take a second to shake out my nerves once the elevator arrives at the dormitories. The kids in the hallway just stare. I keep my eyes focused straight ahead until I get to my door. By the second my hand hits the knob, I hear, "Why are you here?" I look up to find Lara and Kirsten coming up the hall. "Same reason you are," I say. "I'm going to be a junior agent, and I'm going to find my brother, and hopefully your sister too. My sister doesn't need any help from a Peters. Got that?" Lara jabs a finger in my direction. "You just focus on your own dumb brother." I just shake my head and turn back to my door.
Guess you thought those hybrid attacks last night were fair payback for that picture somebody left on your wall, says Kirsten, crossing her arms. I whirl back to face them. Are you serious? I had nothing to do with that. So you say, says Laura. You're being dumb, I say. Kirsten steps closer. Watch your back, freak. I take a step back. What's that supposed to mean? Exactly what it sounds like, answers Laura. You three, break it up, calls Bertha from down the hall. But I can't let that be the end of it. I won't let anyone intimidate me anymore. I look them both square in the eyes and say, I'm not scared of you. You should be, spits Laura. For as brave as I'm trying to be, the words still give me chills. Elsie arrives at the dorm just before lights out, only half awake. She texted me earlier to say she and her guardian were up all night volunteering to help those who were hurt in last night's hybrid attacks. My best friend smiles, gives me a quick hug, and then falls over onto her bed fast asleep. I had hoped to update her on what Dylan and I found on my brother's computer, since I haven't gotten the chance yet, but it's clear she needs the rest. Lights out comes and goes, and I sit cross-legged on my bed with Noteworthy Agents, Heroics, Scandals, and everything in between. I borrow Elsie's sneak candle and put it right up against the wall so its light won't reach her. After reading Vanquish's long entry near the end, I flip back a few pages and skim through Agent Magnus's paragraph to find that his talent for being tough-skinned got enhanced to steel-skinned after touching the crystal ball. And Agent Fiona nearly caused an international incident when, as a junior agent, she greatly offended the origami hive mind by insisting that scissors beats paper in a game of rock-paper-scissors. The lightest knock, really more of a tap, sounds on my door. I slide out of bed, tiptoe across the room, and just barely crack open the door to have a look. A pretty girl in a white flower tiara peeks through the sliver of doorway. Hello, Amari. I'm here to escort you to the Department of Good Fortunes. She grins wide. And bad omens. Her face falls. Really? I thought my appointment wasn't until next week. You've been granted a special top priority appointment by the chief herself. Something about ensuring that your being here won't bring doom and despair to the bureau. The usual. No biggie. Okay. It sounds like a pretty big deal. If I wanted to ask Director Horace something important, could I? Of course, she replies. But maybe wait till the end so you don't interrupt the show. Now get dressed. Oh, and bring your raincoat. Why do I need a raincoat? For the rain, silly. I close the door, a little dazed by the sudden turn my night has taken. In the closet, my favorite pair of jeans and the jet black I Heart Books t-shirt Quentin got me last year are waiting for me. Matching black sneakers sit just below them. This must be what I meant to wear, because there's even a bright yellow raincoat with my Moonstone badge attached to the front. I dress quickly and turn off the sneak candle. In the hallway, I get my first good look at my junior fortune teller escort. She's wearing a fancy white dress that glows in various places. Cool dress, I say. Isn't it? I made it myself, the girl replies. The secret is to weave Christmas lights into the fabric. She twirls and then curtsies. The name is January. Very pleased to make your acquaintance. I try to return the curtsy, but it ends up being an awkward bow. January doesn't seem to mind. Shall we? She says. As we move through the halls of the youth dormitories, more kids slip out of their rooms. One girl emerges with a purple velvet cape and crown, A boy skips into the hallway in a thick fur coat, a large pair of antlers perched atop his head.
Are all of you from the Department of Good Fortunes and Bad Omens?
January nods. Our dress code is to wear whatever makes us happiest. We're a free-spirited bunch.
Do you all make your own clothes?
A lot of us do. But honestly, if you go to the Dubois clothing website on the other net, you can almost always find exactly what your mind has dreamed up. That's when I realize I've never seen anyone dressed like this during the day.
Do you guys only work at night?
We do, but it's not that unusual. There are quite a few departments with nighttime business hours. The Department of Dreams and Nightmares, the Department of the Dead, and I believe the Department of the Unexplained as well. Oh, and the Department of Supernatural Health is always open, 24 hours a day. A girl dressed like Santa Claus rushes over to January and clutches both her hands. Let me guess. Strawberries? January giggles. You're always getting your futures and histories mixed up. Strawberries Jubilee was my name yesterday. Tonight, I'm January Winterfrost. The other girl nods her approval and then runs off to catch up with a group up ahead. One of them is wearing a fully inflated blue balloon. The others have already stopped an elevator for us. I scan their faces for any sign of magician hate, but they appear much more interested in each other's costumes. January gives them her thanks as the elevator doors shut. I instantly recognize the elevator as Lucy.
Not used to seeing you out and about this late at night, says Lucy.
She's to meet with the Starlight Shaman himself, says January.
Lucy coos.
The director Horace sure has a dreamy voice.
January blushes, and they both laugh. It surprises me when Lucy announces we've entered the Vanderbilt Hotel.
Are we going outside?
I ask, thinking about the raincoat in my arms.
Yes and no, says January.
Finally, Lucy says, now approaching the Department of Good Fortunes and Bad Omens. The doors open to a huge circular room that I realize must be the inside of the large golden dome atop the hotel. The dome is split into halves. The walls on the right side show cute furry animals in green meadows filled with flowers of every color. Happy cherubs take aim at grinning couples, and children laugh and dance. The left side of the dome is totally different. Ugly monsters twist themselves around dark spaces filled with angry green eyes. Some bear sharp fangs, others have sneaky grins. All the people on this side look sad, terrified, or furious. I guess one side represents good fortunes, while the other side represents bad omens. I just hope my visit falls on the good fortune side of things. There's a big white pillar in the middle of the room. A black staircase wraps around it, leading up to the viewing end of a telescope that stretches up to the ceiling. Most of the room is filled with curved tables, arranged in concentric circles around the pillar. It reminds me of the solar system. If the pillar is the sun, then these tables are like the orbits the planets take, making bigger and bigger circles the farther you get away. The only difference is there's a walkway that leads straight from the elevator to the pillar. As January leads me to the pillar, I glance at the little station spread out along the tables. Some have crystal balls that cloud up as we pass. A few have stacks of tarot cards, and others have bowls with small bones inside. On the bad omens side, I see a book titled Cursed or Blessed with Bad Luck, a subtle but important difference. Further ahead, a blazing fire burns, with little pillows spread out around it. January follows my gaze. That's for pyromancy. If you really concentrate and stare into the fire for long enough, you'll start to see glimpses of the future amidst the flames. We're trained in 12 different methods of fortune telling. Once we go around the pillar, I spot a doorway with a plaque that reads, Office of the Director. We pause in the doorway. It's pretty empty for an office. No desk or chairs or anything on the walls. There's only a big, dark-skinned guy in deep blue robes and a matching blue African kufi hat embroidered with silvery stars. He sits with his back to us on a wide blue carpet with silver trim.
Hello there,
he says in a deep, rumbling voice. The sound makes me smile. It's like far-off thunder.
Welcome to the Department of Good Fortunes and Bad Omens.
Thanks, I say. Glad to be here? Director Horace stands and turns with a swish of his robes. Golden eyes gleam above his neatly trimmed goatee.
January, thank you for escorting Amari. Do me a favor and check the conditions.
Will do, says January. Before leaving, she glances to me and says, He always guesses my name right. Those golden eyes look to me now, and Horace waves me inside.
Please remove your shoes and have a sit on my carpet.
I do what he says, and we both sit cross-legged across from one another. If I wasn't nervous about this meeting before, I certainly am now. If you decide my being here is a bad omen, does that mean I'll be kicked out of the bureau?
Don't worry yourself, says Director Horace. Tonight's reading is merely a precaution. Atlanteans, like Chief Crow, see every oddity as an omen for calamity. So when a magician shows up at the bureau around the same time it's being attacked, it's only natural that the chief would want answers.
Then you don't think me being here is a bad omen? I ask.
I have learned to wait for what will be revealed to be revealed, says Director Horace.
That isn't exactly the no I hoped for, but then it isn't a yes either. It's pouring outside, says January from behind me. Director Horace grins.
Perfect.
He stands and stretches.
Are you ready for a ride?
I stand up too. Sure.
Stand next to me on the center of the carpet, says Director Horace.
January pulls open a hidden drawer in the wall, then reaches inside and takes out a long silver staff. She tosses it over, and Director Horace catches it in one hand. January closes the drawer and then presses herself tightly against the wall, almost as if she's trying to keep out of the way. Pieces began to click into place in my mind. Wait, I say, looking down at the fancy blue carpet beneath our feet. This isn't a flying go, shouts Director Horace. The carpet comes to life beneath our feet. It bucks and wriggles and then jumps forward, bending at the edges to fit through the open doorway. We fly in fast circles around the top of the dome, while a crowd of upturned faces cheers us on. A panel slides away, and Director Horace spins his staff until it becomes an umbrella that he opens with a flick of his wrist. We dash out into blinding rain. I can sort of make out the lit-up windows from tall buildings, enough to figure out that we're rising higher and higher. I grab hold of Director Horace's arm. The rain comes at us sideways. I try to get a look to see how he's handling all this rain, but I can only just make out the golden glint of his eyes. We continue like this, soaring through the storm until suddenly, the rain stops. Next thing I know, we're above the clouds, a starry night sky all around us. My teeth chatter as I pull my jacket on tighter. It's cold up here. Director Horace closes the umbrella and sets it down next to his bare feet. That's when I remember my own wet feet.
A beautiful night, he says,
staring up at the sky.
I'm soaked and freezing,
is all I can manage at the moment. Director Horace grins.
As am I.
But what we're here to do won't take very long, I promise.
How can he be so calm when I'm halfway to becoming an Amari popsicle?
What are we here to do?
We're here to cast constellations.
He points to the stars above.
These constellations have been set for tens of thousands of years. They describe the history of our planet itself, moving ever so slowly with the passage of time.
What do they say?
I have no idea.
Director Horace laughs.
They're written in language long forgotten. But as you are very young, your constellation should be easy enough to figure out.
My constellation?
Director Horace nods. Hold out your hand.
I do. And then I watch as Director Horace reaches up to pluck a star right out of the sky. He drops the speck of twinkling light into my palm. Then another, and another. He continues until my hand is covered in a pile of warm, shimmering flecks.
Finally, he says, that should be plenty.
And with one broad swipe of his staff, he knocks loose the remaining stars from the sky. My eyes widen as they drop down around us like glowing dust. An inky dark sky now stretches out above us.
Am I really holding whole stars in my hand?
I ask.
Not the stars themselves, but their spirits. Every natural thing exists in two places, both here and there. If we are physically here, then we are spiritually there. Likewise, if the stars are physically out there, then it only makes sense for them to be spiritually here. Do you understand?
Not really, I say.
Director Horace lets out a low chuckle. Well, if you wish to learn more about these things, you're more than welcome to come try out for my department next summer. It's been many a century since a Moonstone badge has graced our doors.
That Moonstone badge is only because I'm a magician, I think.
Don't sell yourself short. From what I've heard, you've done quite well so far.
I smile at that.
We'll begin with a look at your history, Horace says next. To understand where you're going, we must first understand where your blood has been. Separate the stardust into two even piles on the carpet.
I do as he says, carefully, molding the mounds of light.
Gather up the first pile of stardust and toss it as high as you can. Jump if it helps.
I scoop up a pile, cupping it with both hands. Then I bend my knees and leap into the air, tossing the glowing sprinkles as far above me as I'm able. The glowing pile soars, exploding against the sky like fireworks, and then reforming into a woman with an elaborate headdress. It shifts into a crouching man with a spear lifted over his head. It changes again to a boy on the edge of a cliff, his gaze on the horizon. I try to be patient as the images continue to shift above me, but my curiosity gets the best of me. What do these images mean?
These are your ancestors. You are descended from great African tribal queens, from fierce warriors who protected the innocent, from renowned travelers who sought the thrill of adventure. Greatness, like all other traits, can be passed down in the blood, from parent to child.
The image continues to shift, this time into a young girl on her knees before a man with a whip. It changes again to show men and women marching, even against the blast of a fire hose. There is resilience in your blood, too. The willpower to endure seemingly insurmountable obstacles. Though your ancestors were once slaves, their descendants fought for equal rights. At the sight, I hold my chin high. Then I see Mama's face in the starlight, smiling as she holds a baby in her arms. I hold my breath at the sight of Quentin's proud face as he loads the briefcase that started all this. "These are the people who know you best," says Director Horace. "You've been greatly loved." My chin quivers. I love them too. Director Horace spins his staff until the whole sky is filled with the faces of my ancestors all at once. "Not a single magician in your family history." He spins the staff over his head, and the stars wink out. "This is the history of your magic, Amari." Completely blank, as if the magic truly began with you. Fascinating. "It's true then. I was born a magician?"
"Apparently so," says Director Horace. "Though I've no idea what that will mean for you. So let's move on to the present and future. Cast the second pile of stardust."
I repeat the same motion as before, tossing the stardust high above my head. There's another explosion of white light, and a twinkling bird takes form.
"That bird represents you as you are right this moment. Notice it hasn't yet taken flight. Its wings are outstretched, its head turned upward. The pose suggests that you are capable of becoming truly special, reaching great heights."
Director Horace goes quiet and steps forward. The bird isn't the only thing being shown. The head of a snake emerges, and the creature winds itself through the legs of the bird, coiling up around it. The director stares intently, and I watch him, anxious to learn what this might mean. A much larger two-headed snake appears. I jump when both its heads bare their fangs. Instead of backing down, the smaller snake shows its fangs too.
"This isn't good," says Director Horace. "I've seen that two-headed snake before. During my own castings, while I was away in the Wandering Isles, it's why I cut my trip short and announced my return."
"What's it mean?" I ask. Director Horace lifts his staff to the sky and waves it in wide circles. The stars swirl above us until the image of a mighty elephant appears.
"This represents the entire Bureau of Supernatural Affairs."
Seconds later, the two-headed snake emerges, coiling itself around the elephant's leg. It waits there for a moment before climbing up to the elephant's neck, where it strikes, bringing the animal to its knees. This time, when I shiver, it isn't from the cold. Director Horace narrows his eyes and strokes his chin.
"Snakes have typically represented magicians in these constellations, chiefly for their potential to do great harm to the caster. You do not appear as a snake, likely because it is your casting. I must admit, however, I don't know what a two-headed snake might represent. It's puzzling. Whatever the case, it would seem you and the Bureau share a common enemy, and that concerns me."
"Do you think the two-headed snake could be Moreau and his apprentice?" I ask. "That's who's planning to destroy the Bureau."
"That would be the most logical guess," he replies.
There is much in your constellation that isn't clear. The snake that sought to protect you, for instance. I don't suppose you have any idea who that magician might be.
Dylan, it has to be. But I can't give away his secret. I don't know.
Director Horace frowns. I'll need to inform the chief about what we've witnessed tonight.
Do I get to stay?
I ask. Absolutely. I saw nothing to indicate that you are a bad omen for the Bureau. If anything, this constellation reinforces the need for protective measures to be put in place to ensure your safety. I don't advise you going home for any more weekend breaks.
But what if I fail a tryout?
I ask. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it. But drastic measures would need to be taken. Whatever this two-headed snake represents, it has taken an interest in you, Amari. And that appears to be a very dangerous position to occupy. While I think on those words, Director Horace twirls his staff, and the stars scatter, returning the night sky to normal.
Before we go back, I say, could I ask you something? About my brother?
Director Horace nods thoughtfully. You want to know why Quentin came to see me on the night Van Quish went missing?
Yes, I say. Was it about his future?
He came to see me about reading the future, but not his own. Director Horace sighs. It's why I had to refuse. Unless it is an emergency, I can never reveal the future of one person to another. Such things are as private as thoughts.
Was he asking about my future then?
I ask. Not yours, he replies. Maria's. Your brother wanted to know if she would ever betray the Bureau.
24. I wake up early the next morning and wait for Dylan near the elevators in the lobby of the director apartments. Since I've got no clue where the Van Helsing's apartment is located, I figure it's the best place to wait for him. A group of junior record keepers awaiting Director Cobblepot shoot me nasty looks and mutter something about unfair badges and stupid magicians, but I ignore them. Dylan and I promised to share whatever we learned, so that's what I'm doing. But I've been dreading it all night. Maria, a traitor? When I finally spot him, I run over. His eyes go wide. Amari, what's up?
Can't talk here, I say. Come with me to the library.
Okay, he says. Should I be worried?
Just come on. It's important.
We take an elevator down to the library and dash into a study room.
What's going on? He asks.
I was casting constellations with Director Horace last night, and I asked him about that meeting we found on Quentin's computer.
He leans closer. And what did he say?
I tell him.
Dylan looks stunned.
But why? You said it yourself. They weren't getting along anymore. They were splitting up. What if Quentin realized she was keeping secrets from him?
I meet Dylan's eyes.
Maria is a magician. What if she accepted Moreau's offer to join them?
Dylan looks so hurt by this accusation that I can't help wondering if I made a mistake telling him.
You think my sister is a traitor?
I don't know, I say. But there had to be a reason for my brother to go behind her back like that.
Dylan pushes himself to his feet.
I'm out of here.
Wait,
I say.
That's not all.
Director Horace knows about you being a magician.
Dylan goes stiff.
He does? How?
I shouldn't have said it like that, I say, shaking my head. This whole thing has me flustered.
I just meant that. He knows there's a magician who wants to protect me. The constellation showed a two-headed snake baring its fangs at me. But there was another snake by my side. He said that snakes are supposed to represent magicians. Dylan thinks for a moment. Of course I'd have your back. That's what partners do. That's why it doesn't make sense for Quentin to think my sister would ever. Let me prove it, okay? You keep looking into what Quentin was up to, and I'll show you my sister isn't a traitor. Okay. I don't know what else to say. Dylan turns to leave, but stops short. Did Director Horace get suspicious about there being another magician on your side? Well, I say. He asked me about it, but I just told him I didn't know. Some of his anger fades. You kept my secret? You should tell people when you're ready. It's a choice I wish somebody had given me. Surprise shows on Dylan's face, and he flushes. Thanks. Now that training has restarted, it's time to learn stun sticks. Agent Magnus paces in front of us, holding up a metal rod. It almost looks like a really fancy pen.
First thing to know about a stun stick is that it's for self-defense purposes only. Once you make junior agent in a few weeks, you and your partner will be assigned to a senior or special agent. Wherever that agent goes, you go. Needless to say, things can get a little hairy when you're out fighting crime. These stun sticks have the power to down an 8-foot Yeti mid-pounce. Which one of you brave souls want to volunteer to demonstrate it?
I think Amari wants to volunteer, shouts Kirsten. I turn to glare at her, but Agent Magnus steps in front of me.
That's so?
He asks. Which is worse, getting zapped by a stun stick blast or chickening out in front of everybody? I swallow. Sure, I'll volunteer. I step up in front of the group, and Agent Magnus offers me the stun stick.
Wait, you want me to zap you? I ask. That's right.
A slow grin spreads over my face. Now we're talking. This might be worth it for how much he teased us about our sloppy sky sprints technique last week.
Now, you'll want to hold it out in front of you and press.
I press the button, and Magnus goes stiff as a board, his thick arms clapping against his sides. He bursts into loud guffawing laughter.
Huh?
I touch the stun stick to my own arm and tap the button. Instantly, both my arms snap to my sides. It's a lot like one of those bear hugs I used to get from my great aunt at Thanksgiving. A few seconds later, I get the sensation of being tickled on the bottoms of both my feet. We pass the stun stick around the room and let each trainee experience what it feels like.
The stun stick works in two ways, says Magnus. First, it immobilizes your opponent, preventing them from attacking. Second, it can lessen whatever ill will your opponent bears you with laughter. At the finale, you will duel against one another in pairs using sky sprints and stun sticks. So go ahead and get your sky sprints on.
I turned to head to the equipment room to get a pair of standard-issue sky sprints. Amari, calls Dylan, waving me over. It takes me by surprise. The two of us haven't talked much since the whole Maria might be a traitor thing. He keeps glancing down at his gym bag.
Yeah? I say.
I picked up something during weekend break. Dylan reaches inside and pulls out a black box with Dubois written in silver across the top. Didn't have a chance to give it to you before, so. I'm so stunned. It takes a second for my brain to catch up.
These are for me?
Dylan lifts off the top. A pair of really cool sky sprints sit inside a velvety box. The white boots have a ghostly shimmer. The tag reads, Dead but Dazzling Collection. All I can do is shake my head in disbelief.
Thank you.
Dylan's whole face reddens.
I mean, you won't get far in those dusty old sky sprints you were using before. And if you fail, so do I.
Right, I say. That makes sense. I wish things with me and Dylan could go back to normal. Please don't let Maria really be a traitor. Over the next week, there's a new report about some outpost or legacy family's home getting overrun by hybrids practically every other day. Elsie said the only reason they haven't canceled the summer training sessions is because Bureau headquarters is probably the safest place for us to be. My days are pretty busy just trying to keep up. Every day I wake up and take classes, study for the finale in the afternoon, and hang out with Elsie at night, which usually means the two of us in a study room not coming up with much about Moreau, KH, or the Black Book. Elsie has been doing her part. She borrowed nearly every book on magical objects from the library, and even brought a few from Director Focus's personal collection, but hardly any of them mention the Black Book. And if they do, it's info we already know. On the days I miss Quentin the most, Elsie and I spend the last few minutes before curfew looking at old magazines about Vanquish. It helps me feel closer to him. On better days, either I'm Elsie's guinea pig for whatever wild invention she's working on, or she's barricading the door and helping me practice my magic. I'm getting better and better at painting illusions by hand. One time, I even changed the color of Elsie's frizzy brown hair to bright pink. She nearly freaked when I pretended that I couldn't remember how to change it back. I can even paint moving illusions now, which are tricky because you have to concentrate so hard to make the movements look natural. The only downside is that in order to keep Dylan's secret, I can't tell Elsie how I got the spell book or how I learned to paint illusions in the first place. I wonder if my aura shows how much I hate hiding things from her. If it does, Elsie never says anything. It's the week of the second tryout, and I'm trudging to the food court when Gemma, Elsie's lab partner, hands me a note to meet her in the library instead. When I get there, she rushes me into a study room. "Did you find something?" I ask. Elsie sighs dramatically. "This is the last book I have access to. It's taken so much sucking up to Director Focus to get her to lend me Rasputin's directory of dangerous doodads and doohickeys. It's the magician's handwritten notes. If there's not anything new about the Black Book in here, then I don't know where else to look." I bite down on my lip and take the seat next to her. "Let's see then." Elsie carefully flips through the pages until she finds an entry for the Black Book. Her eyes scan it top to bottom before her face falls. "Nothing new." As bad as I feel, Elsie looks even more upset. I know she's been working crazy hard to finding something that would help. So I pull out my own spell book to cheer her up. Elsie looks over as I slip the key into the lock and she sits up.
"Of course! I'm such an idiot! All this time!"
She reopens the book, flipping past the Black Book entry until she lands on a new page.
"The Black Key. If only a spare few know about the Black Book, even fewer are aware of the key necessary to open it. After Vladimir's death, the Bureau of Supernatural Affairs was tasked with protecting the Black Book from Moreau and those magician apprentices who avoided capture. Not trusting humanity to possess both the Black Book and the Black Key, the inaugural Supernatural World Congress bestowed the Black Key upon an anonymous key holder whose duty it was to hide and protect it. This duty is to be passed down through generations, with each new key holder honor-bound to never reveal themselves. The Black Book and the Black Key are never to be brought together under any circumstances. Therefore, the Supernatural World Congress forbids the Bureau from ever seeking out the key. For if it does, then it has broken its foremost oath and shall be forever dismantled, its members immediately banished from the supernatural world.
KH means keyholder, says Elsie, eyes wide, pointing to the page. That's what, or I guess who, Vanquish found.
I bite my lip and nod. No wonder Moreau's apprentice went after my brother. If there really is some master plan to take back the Black Book, then they'll need the Black Key to open it.
This is bad, says Elsie, dropping her voice to a whisper. If anyone finds out about this, the entire Bureau would be shut down for breaking its oath.
Then for now, we don't say anything to anyone, I say.
What about Dylan? Asks Elsie.
I don't know yet. Because Maria Van Helsing might be Moreau's apprentice. Now that Elsie and I are out of clues, and the second tryout is only a couple days away, we decide to shift all our focus into not failing. It would be different if we knew who the keyholder was. Then we could at least send a warning somehow, if it's not already too late. Hopefully Quentin hasn't told Moreau's apprentice anything, but I don't like to think about the ways a magician might go about making someone talk. A couple times I've wanted to tell Dylan about what we found, but it seems like he's avoiding me. He's even been pairing up with Lara instead of me in Sky Sprint training. I almost wish I'd never said anything about Maria. All the trainees from every department have been studying and practicing like crazy. Hardly anyone shows up for lunch anymore. If not for Elsie, I'd be right there with them. My roommate doesn't believe in missing meals, and apparently that rule goes for me too. Last time I told her I planned to skip lunch to finish Uniforms of the Bureau of Supernatural Affairs, a guide, she picked me up and carried me here. As I finish off a taco, Elsie goes on and on about some new flea grenade that the Agent Support Division of the Department of Magical Science is working on. That's where she wants to end up when she makes junior researcher. They come up with all the cool gadgets that agents use to fight crime. A flea grenade isn't as mean as it sounds, says Elsie. My fleas tickle the Yetis into submission. It's actually a lot like how a stun stick works now that I think about it. I just smile at Elsie. If I thought I was doing well by ranking first in the previous tryout, that's nothing compared to how much the researchers love Elsie. She's the only trainee to be invited to Director Focus's movie night for the intellectually inclined. Apparently, they just sit around watching really boring documentaries that only geniuses would find entertaining. Whatever the second tryout for researcher trainees is, it'll be no sweat for that girl. Are the Yetis really as bad as everyone makes them seem? I ask. Elsie nods. The worst. They think they own the whole forest. They throw the most ridiculous tantrums. Some sports team just mentioned one of their forests as a possible spot to build a stadium, and the Yetis proceeded to buy the team and trade away all the good players. They're that rich? Yep, she answers. They own a really popular ice cooler company. Hey, Amari, you got a sec? Elsie and I both look up to find Dylan standing over us. Sure, I say. I follow Dylan to an empty table. So, I have a friend who heard it from another friend whose brother is a junior agent, who walked in on Agent Fiona telling my dad about the second tryout being a treasure hunt inside the Bureau. He said Agent Fiona made it clear that the only way to pass is to have a really good understanding of the Bureau. Are you sure it was real? I ask, because Lara seemed pretty certain she knew what the first tryout would be too. That was just my sister wanting to be the center of attention. This is legit. I chew on my lip. How many people know about this? All the agent trainees,
but you weren't there, so I came to find you. He's being nice about it, but I know what he really means. The magician wasn't invited to the secret meeting. Thanks for telling me, I say. But I bet all the copies of ins and outs and in-betweens of the Bureau are checked out by now. No worries, he says. I have my own. We can study together. Oh, I say, surprised. That would be cool. He goes a little red. I've been thinking, and I know you only said what you said about Maria, because that's where the investigation led you. If the situation were reversed, I'd have done the same. Just please keep an open mind, okay? Let's treat my sister like she's innocent until we know for sure. I can do that, I say. A smile spreads across his face, and he holds out his fist. Vanquish 2.0? I smile and bump his fist. Vanquish 2.0. 25. Agent Fiona throws her arms open and shouts, "Welcome to the second tryout. By the end of the day, we'll be saying goodbye to half the remaining trainees, bringing our numbers down from 16 to 8. But if ye do pass this tryout, then all you'll need to worry about is the finale next week. No more surprises. I'm sure the lot of ye could do with a bit more certainty in your lives." The 16 of us sit in the briefing auditorium of the Department of Supernatural Investigations. Agent Fiona and Agent Magnus stand on stage next to a large basket of eggs. You know you've been here for a while when weird stuff like that doesn't even faze you. I've been looking around for Dylan since I got here, but there's no sign of him or his sister. In a moment, we're gonna ask that you partner up and send one representative from each pairing up to the stage to collect your first clue. Magnus leans over and says something in Agent Fiona's ear. "My apologies. I haven't even said what you're getting a clue for, have I? This tryout is a treasure hunt, seeking to test your ability to puzzle out clues in high-pressure situations. An agent has got to be quick on their feet to determine the next move. To that end, we'll be sending each pair on a unique path through the Bureau. In each location, you'll receive a new clue that leads to the next department. The first four pairs to finish the treasure hunt will receive an invite to the finale. Go on and pair up." Kids jostle to get a seat next to their partners. I look for Dylan, but he's nowhere to be found. If he waits much longer, I might have to go it alone. With everything that's riding on this tryout, just the thought makes me nervous. Dylan and Laura finally walk in together. From the way they glare at each other, I can tell they've probably been arguing. Laura turns her back on him as he's talking and goes to partner up with Kirsten. Dylan just rolls his eyes and glances around the auditorium. I wave a hand. He comes over and takes the seat next to me. "You and Laura not getting along?" I ask. Dylan sighs and shakes his head. "I might have promised her that we'd be partners once we were able to choose, but that was before the summer. Things change, you know? I bet she's going to rush off and whine to Dad if she doesn't do well in this tryout." I can't believe Dylan is willing to anger his dad and Laura just to be my partner. "Well, thanks for not bailing on me." He shrugs. "Partners, remember?" Agent Fiona calls out, "Our first place team decided to remain partners, it seems. Both of ye come on down and collect the first clue. You'll get a 30-second head start on the rest of the trainees. Doesn't sound like a lot, but you'll get the benefit of not having to share an elevator." I let Dylan reach into the basket to select our clue. It comes in an egg that look so real I'm half expecting to find a yoke inside. Once every team has one, Agent Fiona says, and don't you give us a hard time about our clues either.